As we decide what to buy and where to vacation, billions of the world's people are scrambling to find shelter and their next meal. What would it take to get real economic justice on planet Earth? In today's Tuesday Brown Bagger, you will hear two sympathetic voices searching for answers. Pier Luigi Sacco teaches the economics of culture in Venice. He's looking at post-industrial economics and cooperation. We'll also hear from Canada's Avi Lewis, now a well-known TV and radio broadcaster, just after the release of his critical movie, The Take. The discussion was hosted by broadcaster Bill Richardson, presented by Van City and the BC Cooperative Association, and recorded by Thomas Hicks of the Necessary Voices Society on June 27, 2006. Part of the recording was rebroadcast by the CBC radio program Ideas for October 13, 2006. Find that in their archives. Most of us do feel guilty about the imbalance of wealth in this world. Let's join Pier Luigi Sacco and Avi Lewis to find out what could be done for global economic justice.
Good evening to everyone, and a warm Van City welcome. So tonight, the dialogue that we will be listening to with Professor Pier Luigi Sacco of the University of Bologna and Avi Lewis, who we all, us avid CBC folks, all know as a producer for CBC News World and more recently producer for the film The Take, are here to continue the dialogue with us.
Further ado, I'd like to welcome our colleague, Pier Luigi Sacco, from the University of Venice.
Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks so much for inviting me here. It's real emotion because, I mean, these days in Vancouver are increasingly involving me into an incredibly thriving local system, which is really full of, I think, interesting experiences that probably will come up to something quite soon. This talk in particular, I think, is very stimulating because the issue of economics and global justice is an issue which is really debated widely, but at the same time, I think, also an issue which is not always framed in the right way. Because, of course, when we talk of global justice, the most direct way of putting it is that there is one half of the world that owns almost everything, and so there must be something bad with it, and of course it does. And then there is the other part of the world that counts almost nothing and owns almost nothing, and so there must be something bad with this too. And this being true, however, is not so clear why so difficult to eradicate this difference, and at the same time, why so difficult to keep really the attention of this issue for a long time enough to make it credible, the objective of eradicating it really. Well, to understand better what's the issue eventually, I think it's important to draw some basic reflection that can be useful in understanding how, in my opinion, the issue of global justice could be framed, well, if not properly, at least I think provocatively, but at the same time constructively. Well, it's clear that the part of the world we are in at present is undergoing a significant transition from what was called an industrial economy to a so-called post-industrial one, whereas the other part of the world did not even get into the industrial part. Well, let's try to understand better what does this mean, actually. Well, post-industrial transition essentially means that we are not really relying on industrial production as a primary means of economic development at the moment. Not because industry is not important, but because most of our economies actually have to do with what comes after industry, which means the service economy and the knowledge economy, and more in particular, the implication of this is that We are not relying so much on industrial production, although, I mean, it's still a significant part, probably even a majoritarian part of our GDP, because basically we are less interested in the actual production and consumption of goods per se for what they are. What do I mean by that? Well, basically, the reason why we have mounted this impressive machine producing this impressive amount of goods was the fact that in our economies, historically for centuries, there has been a strong demand for basic goods, which means foods and, of course, garments and protection, housing protection and basic medical care and whatever. And these goods are absolutely necessary, whatever your cultural context and whatever your geographical location. So basically, traditional economics has to do with meeting basic needs. And these basic needs are somewhat universal, okay? But what has happened quite recently is that a very large part of our world economic system was able to call itself out of what we could call the survival economy, which meant that the representative individuals in this world can think of themselves as being freed by this threat of survival. What do I mean by that? Well, how many of you just waking up this morning thought of getting enough food as a real concern? Well, possibly, if you thought about food, the concern was not getting enough of it, but possibly, I mean, staying away enough from food. So this is the problem. I mean, for virtually all the generations that preceded us, the opposite concern was the rule. Not, of course, for a privileged elite, but for a very important part of the society, and a part large enough to determine basically the orientation of the productive system. What a post-industrial economy is, basically, is exactly a world in which people do not think of themselves in terms of needs, but possibly in terms of desires, which are something totally different. Desires are disposable, and they are not as mandatory as needs, whatever the advertising campaigns can tell us. Because, well, when we are starving for 3 days, I mean, we cannot think of anything but food, okay? And it is a biological mechanism that was the outcome of an evolution that prompted this signal to our brain strongly enough, I mean, to make it solvable as a problem. So the issue is that when we are in a survival economy, basically, we think of needs. When we are outside it, needs are replaced by something else that we call desire. Well, basically, needs are structured so deeply our way of thinking to economics that even when we are out of this phase, we still keep on thinking that way. And this creates a lot of distortions that reflect on the way we think about global justice. What do I mean by that? Well, basically, needs induce the concept of scarcity, okay? Because when you are hungry and at the same time, or at least you face the possibility of being hungry, but at the same time you have to ensure your children enough garments or a decent education or whatever, there is of course a dramatic trade-off between this. And so, the essence of economics in this context is just trading off possible uses of the same resources. There are people who actually say, and I mean, for a long time they said that correctly, that the essence of economics is exactly this. I mean, finding out intelligent, efficient way in the economic parlance to allocate resources to different alternative uses, which mean exactly scarcity. The resources are not enough to meet all possible uses that are productive from your point of view. But in an economy in which actually the problem of getting the food to survive or any other kind of good that meets basic needs is actually solved because you don't think in those terms. What is the driver behind economic choices? Well, it will take a long time to argue that in detail, but I invite you to think in terms of identity. The hallmark of a post-industrial economy is that basically people think in terms of identity when they make their choices. What do I mean by that? They are not just meeting a need that, I mean, is prompted by our body, by the utter necessity that we face. And so what they actually do is thinking in terms of, if I buy this, how will other people perceive me? Or if I buy this, what kind of person I am for buying this? Why this is becoming so relevant? Well, before answering to that, let's just look at how people in the marketing departments actually address you when they try to sell you those goods. Well, they address you exactly in this respect. Well, the product itself is somewhat disappearing from the central stage. What's just coming up is the kind of person who buys this kind of goods, or the symbolic representation of the good rather than the good itself, to the point that actually they don't even make promises about what exactly that product delivers. What they promise is how you feel about that good, which is totally different. The economics of identity is a tricky field because it's entirely new. We don't know anything about it. Opposite to the case of the survival economy that can be very tough, but we have been with it for thousands of years and we have learned something in terms of instinct. We know how to address starvation and all other stuff like that. But we don't know how to address the problems of building of identity. Why should these problems be, you know, threatening? Well, consider this. If scarcity is the hallmark of the economics of survival, what does it mean thinking in terms of scarcity in the economics of identity? Basically, what becomes scarce in this context is not the availability of goods. They are anything but scarce, okay? There are plenty of them. It's a sort of invasion. We simply can't just protect ourselves by this attack of goods, I mean, popping up everywhere. But what becomes scarce is, who can you pretend to be? Think of this. I mean, what's the actual rationale behind TV shows like, let's say, Big Brother or American Idol? Basically, the idea that passing enough times through the media, through the television, you acquire a special essence that in some sense makes you shine, okay? Just because you pass through it. And it makes a difference because you were there, whereas most of the people have to be on the other side of the TV set. So the only reason why this makes you different is the fact that very few people in relative terms can achieve that. So that's a new form of scarcity. And it's in its most impressive way, it has nothing to do with your personal characteristics. You can be simply a hanger, okay? Just hang around your hip dresses, okay? And, I mean, that's enough. Insofar as you pass a sufficient number of times through the media. This is a very peculiar effort that was, for example, described with a extraordinary visionary wisdom by Andy Warhol when he argued about the fact that everyone has the right to have a quarter hour of celebrity. Okay? And that's exactly what's happening. a quarter of an hour of celebrity, because, okay, you pass through it, but it is as if, I mean, it's like a battery that progressively, whose charge progressively goes down, okay? Because you're just passing through it, but nothing else happens. If you have no talent, of course, this happens, but just for a while.
This is the Tuesday Brown Bagger, your noon hour brain food, from CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. We have Pierluigi Sacco and Avi Lewis working through the problem of global economic justice.
But nevertheless, this is thrilling. And what is even more thrilling is the spectacle of the people who fail, the ones who participate to the show but cannot get through it. So identity can be highly competitive and so can create scarcity, exactly as goods can be scarce. But the point is that this new kind of scarcity is much more threatening to a degree, because when you are, I mean, on the wrong side of the game, and you are, I mean, in the old economy, in which being on the old, on the wrong side of the game means being starving, okay? Okay, you are desperate to a degree, but you can find some way to find out a reason for that. Was it just, I mean, okay, I am poor, but I'm gaining eternal life because I am on the poor side. But if you are denied in your identity, where you can go? I mean, you are just crap. And that's terrible. This is a new form of suffering. Absolutely. That's becoming an issue. I think that most of the forms of compulsive behavior that are mounting in societies like ours can be traced back to this. I mean, the amount of frustration that each single person in this kind of economy is going to swallow every day is overwhelming. And from the point of view of economic development, this is absolutely good news, because one of the consequences of this is that people are increasingly recurring to compensatory forms of consumption that adds up substantially to the GDP. And, on the other hand, since identity can be thought of as competitive, not only you have to compensate when, let's say, you are clearly on the losing side, but you could be willing to compensate even if you could be apparently on the winning side but less winning than someone else. Because it's so highly competitive that, let's say, you are a movie star, but a not-so-successful movie star. Okay, a lot of frustration all the time, okay? So, what's interesting about this way of developing identity is that it's producing an enormous amount of frustration, even if the economic indicators in the traditional sense always tell about the good news. So one could ask, well, what has all this to do with global justice? Well, the point is that in an economics of identity, people do not even know about what all scarcity is. They simply don't know. I mean, the generation of people that are now, let's say, teenagers, how could they meaningfully relate to a world in which there's not enough to eat? Can you imagine? It's like Mars. Something that is so beyond your everyday experience that you couldn't really imagine. So in this kind of situation, talking about starving people somewhere else has a totally different effect that it could have on generations that were grown in a different world. For example, in a world in which starvation was not a reality but a possibility. Just to make an example, I was born in the middle of the 60s, and in Europe, in the middle of the 60s, if you were born there, for example, in Italy, as I did, you would have a granny that was alive and young during the Second World War, in which they were starving. And so, when I was grown up, I heard tales about starvation or possible starvation, and that was part of my world. So I was, in some sense, midway through. But those generations that had parents and grandparents that did not experience in turn this kind of thing, in some sense, are completely outside the economics of survival, and they are so deeply rooted into the economics of identity that for them, scarcity in a real sense is an abstraction. Total abstraction. For these kind of people, in some sense, the only rational that the image of starving people could have, if we reason in the competitive sense that I've just defined in terms of identity building, the only reason for getting interested into the images of people starving are, well, I'm not that bad after all. I mean, there is someone in the ranking which is lagging far behind. So it's quite a consolation to a degree. Have you noticed how often, for example, in magazines, the advertisements of luxury forms of consumption are mounted in the same two-page opening in which you find, let's say, photo services about Africa or whatever? Is much more common than one could reasonably expect. And the reason is exactly that. Image, okay, but here it is. I mean, a diamond ring or whatever, or luxury perfume, okay? So, I mean, you're far away from that. It's an abstraction, but it's an abstraction you don't really have to care about. So, in this kind of context, can we reasonably expect that people are willing to give up a substantial part of their income or their possibilities to make significant transfers to the other part of the world in which there is this significant scarcity in the traditional sense? Well, most people, politically, I mean, as a society, as a voting society, will answer you, not at all. I mean, my problem is that I have not enough income. How could I give that up? I mean, I'm just lagging behind my neighbor, as I mentioned, that is twice as big as mine. Okay, I have to, you know, keep up with him. So can you ask me that? Absolutely not. That's exactly the reason why all this populist policy of promising tax cuts are basically so effective throughout the world, in particular throughout the Western world, in which their electorate tends to be exactly that kind of electorate that is very sensible to these kind of messages. So the point is, we cannot really realistically talk about global justice if we do not change the way in which we build our identities here. Because otherwise, it's just wishful thinking. There are no political conditions for implementing any redistributive policy that has a real chance to change the things. What is even worse is the fact that even in the so-called underdeveloped economies, the economics of identity is biting, and is bitterly biting, which means that you can find places in which people have hardly enough income to feed their children, but they have parabolic antennas to watch the TV, and they find their own forms of luxury consumption, which is linked to identity, because we live in a globalized economy also from the communicational point of view. And these kind of incentives, exactly as they bite in the Western countries, they bite in the same way, possibly even worse, in the so-called under-industrialized ones. So this means that in this kind of economies, the issues of sheer survival and the issues of identity building are in some sense melting in the same pot, which is even more complicated and will lead, I think, to dynamics that we cannot actually foresee at the moment. But then the point is, to implement global justice, the first thing to do is to think in terms of human development. But what is interesting is that the issue of human development, as I will explain in a moment, is equally important for the sake of global justice, both in the under-industrialized and in the post-industrial countries. In the under-industrialized ones, of course, it has to do with the fact that human development, as Amartya Sen, the famous Nobel Prize for Economics, authoritatively teaches, means that if you are learned enough to understand what are the real choices that you are facing, then, of course, you have a real chance to use the resources, the scarce resources that you have, to improve your condition. And he makes a quite telling example. For example, he compared the results of an inquiry that was made in two different states of India, one in which the health conditions were significantly close to the Western standards, and the other one in which they were completely away from it. And the actual object of the inquiry was understanding whether the local population understood the link between the prevailing condition in terms of hygiene and their probability of getting sick. And in the developed Indian context, the conditions were close to the European ones or the North American ones, and so the actual probability was relatively low because the hygienic prescriptions were readily followed. Whereas in the other context, you had terrible situation, people living in the same room as animals, in the worst possible condition that you can imagine. Well, to the apparent surprise, it was found that people living in the developed context were believing that they were exposed to possible contagion and sickness much more than people living in the disastrous environment. Why? Because in the second case, they didn't even think of the possibility of getting sick because of bad hygiene. So what Sen means by capability is exactly building that frame of mind that allows people to understand what's the relationship between the choices that you do every day and the consequences that they have for your well-being. And so, in that kind of society, it's important to work in terms of basic education to attain this. But is this so different when we rework it in terms of identity for a society like ours? Not at all. It's exactly the same. The problem is that we systematically misunderstand the relationship between our choices and our well-being in a different context, through different channels, exactly as Indians in a strongly underdeveloped context misunderstand the relationship between their hygienic standards and their exposure to sickness. So the point is, what kind of policies are really needed in terms of human development in a context like ours to implement global justice? Well, the point is that we have to discard as quickly as possible this mechanical transposition of the logic of scarcity that we have learned from our past to the economics of identity, which means that we have to cease thinking in terms of competitive identities, identities which are scarce. It's absolutely not necessary. You can construct your identity through goods that are not available to someone else, but you can equally construct your identity in terms of access to meaningful experiences. The point is that in the first case, all you need is income. And this can be a perverse mechanism because for getting this income, you could give up, for example, opportunities of social interaction that lock you up progressively into a situation in which you are alone and you need more consumption just to mend this, you know? But constructing identity through access to experiences means investing on yourself. Because for these experiences to be appealing to you, you have to develop all the information and capabilities that are needed to be into these experiences in a meaningful way. If, for example, you have an opportunity, let's say, to go to a beautiful concert, but you don't have the basic skills that are needed to attend in an enjoyable way, a difficult kind of music, or just to talk to someone about a possible, for example, making a kind of travel that requires some background information without which, this is just, entertainment, just moving your entertainment to another place, but in a totally shallow way. Well, if you don't have these basic skills, in some sense, your world of experience is too small, and you just compensate for this smallness in terms of access to goods.
It's CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver with the Tuesday Brown Bagger program, where we present the best of Vancouver speeches. Today, Italian Pier Luigi Sacco and Canadian broadcaster Avi Lewis discuss the problem of global economic justice.
But the point is that if you actually manage to build an identity which is based on the access to experiences, you need less and less reliance on the material side of consumption for the simple reason that compensatory consumption is no longer needed. And this, of course, frees a lot of resources that can be redistributed in a situation in which you do not perceive these as threatening your standards of life. So the actual issue is we are building an incredible gap in our society between our possible access to experiences that are really satisfactory in terms of well-being. Our societies are constructing landscapes of experience for people that are absolutely unprecedented. No society before ours puts so many individuals in the position of experiencing so many different things, so stimulating so easily. But at the same time, our society is not developing at all the human skills that are needed to enjoy them. On the contrary, there's a very strong incentive in making people dumber and dumber for the simple reason that this makes you more manipulable and in particular more exposed to this selling on compensatory consumption. So the point is that policies have to be readdressed to stimulate social dynamics that lead people to invest on themselves. Not only this betters the functioning of a market economy, it betters democracy, first of all, for the simple reason that people who are aware of the possibilities because they invest on themselves and so know exactly what are the trade-offs behind one choice are, of course, carry in their own democratic decisions much more information than people who simply ideologically respond to things they don't understand. So the point is that global justice, I think, is mainly a problem that we have to solve at home, paradoxically. In the sense that if we begin solving this problem here and in the first place create a different way of relating the production of welfare and the control of resources in our part of the world, then it becomes so much easier to redistribute part of it in a politically sustainable way. And an impressive confirmation of this comes from a graph on which economists, I mean the more open-minded ones, are really thinking about in past 10 years or so. And this graph simply plots the average income per capita in the various economies, in the various societies, against self-perception of well-being as measured in a representative sample in the local population of each given nation. Well, it turns out that below $10,000 American dollars per capita, the relationship between availability of income and perception of well-being is extremely steep, which means that even $100 more make an enormous difference. Well, this is exactly the economics of survival. But what happens beyond the threshold roughly $10,000 per capita? The same curve that was previously steep, almost vertical, becomes suddenly horizontal. There's practically no gain in terms of perception of well-being when you double the average income per capita of an economy beyond the level of $10,000 per year per capita. This means that it doesn't mean that money becomes inessential beyond that level, of course. But it simply means that the channels through which we build our well-being are simply different. they are no longer the same. And the problem is that if we do not perceive the policy implications for that, we can be, gratified by campaigns that tell us, okay, how important it is to work toward global justice and so on. But in some sense, we are part of the show. We are just playing a part in a role game, in a role play that, accounts for us exactly as accounts for the radical liberistic capitalists that simply say it's part of the game. What we really need is to begin a totally new different of economic policy in which the real target becomes the mindscape of people. If we are able to enlarge the mindscape of people, then we build room for social justice at the global level. Thank you.
I'm John Rostakis. I'm the executive director for the BC Cooperative Association. BCCA is one of the three sponsoring organizations for the Bologna Summer Program for Cooperative Studies, of which this lecture series is a part of. And the other two being Vancity, of course, and the University of Bologna. And it has been a great pleasure and a real privilege to welcome, as part of this lecture series, people like Pierluigi Sacco and John Helliwell and John McKnight from the United States. And last year we had Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner for economics, offering a public dialogue on globalization and its discontents, along with Stefano Zamani from the University of Bologna. And as you can see from tonight's beginning, a similarly stimulating and provocative discussion on the subject of economics and global justice, and from, I think, two very different perspectives, equally compelling, I believe, equally stimulating and provoking some serious reflection on what the dimensions truly are when we address a subject as large and as complex as this. I am very happy now to introduce our next speaker, Avi Lewis, who all of you, I'm sure, will be familiar with. He hardly needs an introduction, but I still get great pleasure from introducing him. I've only recently come to know Avi from work that I had previously approached him on for a video project that the BC Co-op Association was involved in to document the cooperative economy of Northern Italy and the use of the cooperative model here in Canada and in the United States. Avi Lewis at the time said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'd like to, but I'm busy with another project which I have to complete, so sorry, I'll have to pass. He was working on another film, and it turned out eventually to be The Take, which focuses very compellingly on cooperatives, in fact, in the experience of workers in their communities in Argentina to respond to the tragic, catastrophic economic crisis in Argentina in 2001, and documenting the struggle of communities and factory workers to recover abandoned factories, transform them into worker cooperatives, and try to bring them back into production and reclaim their working lives and the lifeblood of their communities. So Avi has become, I think, one of the really expert, I think, educators and proponents of the cooperative model through his work as a filmmaker, and in particular the completion of The Take. He has been a journalist. He has been a CBC broadcaster. He has been host of Counterspin, a very popular current affairs program for News World. And he just informs us that he's about to launch a new project on CBC News World this September called The Big Picture, which is a series of presentations of documentaries followed by town hall discussions on the issues that they raise. So, journalist, broadcaster, filmmaker, activist, and inheritor of a proud family activist tradition. I'd like to ask Gavi to come up and give us his presentation on his subject and ask you to help me welcome him to do so.
Hi there. How are you? Thank you, John. Thanks, Pierluigi, and to Van City as well. I'm screwed. I was going to give exactly the same talk that you just heard. So we got problems out of the gate here. Actually, thank you, because I will never watch myself watching American Idol the same way again. I might have a slightly different take on the topic, which I think is probably why we were invited. But one which will make for an interesting conversation, which we're going to have as soon as I'm done ranting at you. I'm actually doubly delighted to be with you tonight to tackle this subject, which is very close to my spleen: the role of economics in global justice. First of all, I'm excited because it's one of those modest, manageable, almost snack-sized subjects that can be easily dealt with in the half hour I've been allotted. In fact, I'm sure I can dispense with this topic in just a few minutes, and we can move on to resolve once and for all the role of politics in global justice, the relationship between militarism and global justice, the role of the justice system in global justice, and we'll still have time for questions. But I'm also delighted to be talking to you about economics because I'm not an economist. And it's rare that someone not formally trained in the arcane interstices of underlying inflation rates, liquidity, and Laffer curves is giving standing in any public discussion of economics. And that, I will argue tonight, is part of the problem. But while I'm not classically attuned to the delicate instrument that is the economy, I am, like any self-respecting punk guitarist, able to bash out a few heartfelt chords. And while they may not have the subtlety of a master's touch, they are as honest as they are hard won. I've actually taken two crash courses in economics in my life in two very distinct times and places. The most recent was in Argentina, where I lived for a good chunk of 2002 and 2003 making a film called The Take, and where I was privileged to observe firsthand the extraordinary emergence of a host of alternative local economic systems: democratic cooperatives, horizontal micro-enterprises, neighborhood trading clubs with their own local currencies, and worker-run businesses from tourist hotels to running shoe factories. And this flowering of economic innovation and participation grew out of the rubble of a ruined economy in a country that had followed all the economic prescriptions of the day and had nonetheless found itself drawn into a dramatic collapse. But my first crash course in economics was back in 1999, when I launched a nightly televised debate show just as the Apex scandal was breaking in Canada. Some of you here are old enough to remember that. The revelations were dramatic, and for Canada, surreal. We had activists kidnapped by unidentified security agents in sedans with tinted windows, students pepper sprayed while sitting sedately in a roadway, free speech advocates arrested for holding signs that said free speech. Some of you do remember. And our government planting rows of trees along procession routes to protect visiting heads of state from the ugly sight of real-time dissent. And as the revelations emerged, the daily debates were about who knew what when and who gave the order and who was in charge. But the larger question was why. Why would our government suppress protest in such a hilariously clumsy way just to ensure an unruffled trade meeting, the star guest of which was an infamous authoritarian who had come to power 30 years earlier in a CIA-backed coup in Indonesia, notable historically for the bloodbath of 500,000 killed? As the debate about the Apex scandal was strategically buried, anti-dramatically bored off the radar, buried in reports and inquiries, it became clear that economics was the why. Not the discipline itself, of course, but a particular orthodoxy within it, and the commitment of our government to the primacy of that program over all other considerations. But as we collectively struggled through the clouds of polemic and pepper spray to an understanding of what that economic agenda really was, that's where the crash course actually began. We had to learn to decode the intentionally mystifying jargon of trade deals. And this new skill, not very sexy, but incredibly important, of poring over hundreds of pages of soporific economic lingo, of learning to spot the policies and to connect the dots to their actual real-world effects. This was the self-taught economics embraced energetically by a whole generation of new political actors who marched onto the world stage in Seattle and Genoa and Monterey and elsewhere. It was a resistance movement that was economically obsessed, dedicated to naming and shaming the policies of the globalization era. An era in which market-friendly manifestos are inserted into the text of every agreement on every table, and a particular branch of economics committed to shrinking government, privatization, and deregulation now reigns supreme in the Borg-like groupthink of the global decision makers. Now, that agenda was not exactly stopped in its tracks. Some of you remember that, too. Quite the contrary. But at the very least, in 1999 in Canada, a debate began about many of those controversial policies that, with the exception of the free trade debate a generation earlier, had started to sail through unchallenged, buried in mounds of protective, impenetrable trade jargon like landmines packed in styrofoam peanuts. And as part of that political moment, I also learned something else about this apparent economic consensus. I learned that economists had not always been obsessed with low inflation, fiscal discipline, and growth, growth, growth. I learned that the role and focus of economics itself had recently been transformed. This fact was recalled to me just last month in an op-ed written by Arthur Donner, an eminent Canadian economist, and Doug Peters, a former bank economist and Liberal MP. Not exactly Lenin and Trotsky, if you know what I mean. And their piece began, "There has been a monumental shift in mainstream economics over the past 40 years. Donner and Peters say that when they studied economics in the 1960s, the role of economists was essentially to design policies that had a number of fundamental objectives. Stimulating growth, of course, but also full employment and the reduction of inequality in society. And those last two goals have fallen completely off the map in the last 30 years. The vision of a society in which everyone has a livable wage and dignified work, and where huge chasms of inequality don't dominate both the national and the global landscape, not the mindscape, the landscape where we live. These goals, until very recently, were what economics was for, something that Pierluigi also said. So I want to take the rest of my time with you tonight to briefly examine three critical questions. Why those priorities have disappeared, what the effect of that shift has been, and how we can take the discipline of economics, which has frankly just become too big for its boots, and put it back in its rightful place. So the disappearance of the principle of redistribution, I submit, is a profound loss to economics. We've known for a very long time that there's enough food produced on the planet for everyone, and yet there are always famines. The world spends more than $1 trillion a year on arms. A mere 20th of that would bring the AIDS pandemic in Africa under control, put every child on that continent in school, and rebuild shattered societies. But even to make that juxtaposition today is to appear a wild-eyed idealist. Redistribution at this point in history is heresy. I don't believe it's just slipped off the mindscape because of a change in identity and scarcity. I believe something else is at work. And I think I understand part of the reason why. It has to do with dreams of pure science, with mathematical infatuation, with the lure of certainty. Somewhere along the line in the last 30 years, in the twilight of Keynesian economics and the triumph of Milton Friedman's monetarism, economics started getting hungry for scientific legitimacy, started aspiring to be a capital S science with immutable laws and universal truths. In the course of this quest, economics became more exclusive. At this point, only self-described technocrats, a whole new class which has arisen with great power in the global economy, only self-described technocrats who claim to be beyond ideology, their eyes fixed on the celestial mechanism of the market, only superhuman oracles like Alan Greenspan now have the deep knowledge considered necessary to tinker with the sensitive machine known as the economy. And when economic rules became more fixed and economic orthodoxy cemented like a 30-year epoxy, global financial bodies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank started applying the same economic formulas to very different economies all over the world. And the economic goals of low inflation, fiscal discipline, and growth became ends in themselves. And we forgot that they were only tools. Economics as a discipline is diminished as a result. But at the same time, the reach of economics has grown enormously. The same principles of market logic are brought to bear on health, education, social services. Trade agreements bring every human good and service into their orbit. Food, energy, water, genes. Greenhouse gas emissions are now seen as a marketable commodity. Now, this elevation of economic rules to the status of scientific doctrine and the homogenization of economic policy around the world is producing some predictable results. In many countries, the rules on paper are indeed working, producing low inflation, smaller governments, greater profits. But for some reason, increasingly difficult for economists to explain, the trickle-down is not working. Or maybe it's proving to be just that, a trickle. Inequality, both between nations and within nations, is reaching epidemic proportions. And this little anomaly is having profound human effects. Economists might call them distortions. Since I'm not an economist, I call them perversions. Let me share with you a few quick examples. Starting at home, as Pierluigi has challenged us to do. Canada's riding the wave of a long economic boom. And the last decade has been an unprecedented time of economic growth and wealth creation in our society. All the economic indicators in vogue these days are golden. Sustained growth, prolonged low inflation, federal surpluses and debt-to-GDP ratios that cause other governments positively to salivate. A dozen years of deep tax cuts and a stock market that has enjoyed historic levels of euphoria. And yet, under the radar, with a media and political class distracted by war and terrorism, there is a time bomb ticking in our society. Inequality is not only deepening when it should be declining, but it's becoming a permanent feature of our economic landscape. In the 1990s, permit me just a quick detour into statistical outrage to try to prove what I'm saying. In the 1990s, while $3 trillion of new wealth was created and corporate profits tripled, students faced tuition and debt that had also tripled. Last year, when Canadian CEOs got an this is my outrage coming through in a statistical form. When you try to squeeze outrage into percentages, it never comes through with the full passion. Last year, Canadian CEOs got an average raise of 39%. I don't know how you did. Last year, the median income actually declined to $24,000. 40% of single mothers in Canada live in poverty, and so does one in five Canadian women. Two-thirds of Canadian families fall short at the end of the year and have to dip into savings or go deeper in debt to get by. And all this wealth, all those beautiful numbers of the past dozen years, have done almost nothing to transform the economic situation of the vast majority of our First Peoples who live in a hidden, less industrialized country within an industrialized country. No matter what economic measure you use, and I did my homework so I know some of them, Gini coefficients, decile analysis, quintile analysis, census and tax data, wealth and income data. The gap between rich and poor just keeps growing in the midst of the best economic performance we have ever enjoyed as a country. And the scary thing, that's not a licensed economic adjective, by the way. The scary thing is that the policies designed to reduce inequality, the tax and transfer system, the welfare system, unemployment insurance, and the minimum wage, have all been reformed, quote unquote, in the same period. As a result, they are not succeeding in closing the gap the way they were designed to do and the way that they've historically done in earlier eras. And so we're witnessing in Canada the rise of a permanent underclass in which women and children and Native Canadians and new immigrants are overrepresented. You may feel that I've been a little hard on economists tonight. And it's true that not all economists are so fixated on the numbers that they're blind to the real-world effects of increasing inequality. In fact, there is one economist out there who sees this with great clarity and is speaking with admirable honesty about it, although to an admittedly small audience. So I'd like to share with you some of his thoughts and shine a brief light on him and his team, because I think the work they're doing tells us more about the direction of our economy than almost anything else I've read in years. Allow me to quote and summarize his work at some length. The world is dividing into two blocks. The plutonomy. Yeah, that's plutocracy economy. The plutonomy, where economic growth is powered by and largely consumed by the wealthy few, and the rest. The key plutonomies are the US, the UK, and Canada. Plutonomies have occurred before, in 16th century Spain, in 17th century Holland, the Gilded Age, and the Roaring Twenties in the US. What are the common drivers of plutonomy? Technology-driven productivity gains, financial innovation, capitalist-friendly and cooperative governments, an internal dimension of immigrants and overseas conquests, invigorating wealth creation, the rule of law, and the patenting of inventions. Often these wealth waves involve great complexity, exploited best by the rich and educated of their time. We project that the plutonomies, the US, UK, and Canada, will likely see even more income inequality disproportionately feeding off capitalist-friendly governments and globalization. I know what you're thinking. This is one of those Marxist sociology profs at York. This is, he's quoting from the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives press release. In fact, the economist responsible for these ideas is A.J. Kapoor, the head of Smith Barney Citigroup's Global Equity Strategy Group in New York. So let me share with you the conclusion that A.J. draws from his now infamous plutonomy thesis. Buy shares in the companies that make the toys that the plutonomists enjoy. Our plutonomy basket includes names like Bulgari, Porsche, Hermes, Ralph Lauren, Four Seasons, Sotheby's, and Tiffany. As the rich have been getting richer, so too stocks associated with the rich have performed extraordinarily well, generating returns of 17.8% per annum since 1985. We think plutonomy is here and is going to get stronger, its membership swelling from globalized enclaves in the emerging world. And if plutonomy continues, if income inequality is allowed to persist and widen, the plutonomy basket should continue to do very well.
The hour is up for the Tuesday Brown Bagger program this week. We'll have to leave it there. You have been listening to Canadian broadcaster Avi Lewis talking about global economic justice. He was preceded by Italian economist and radical thinker Pierluigi Sacco. The discussion was hosted by broadcaster Bill Richardson, presented by Van City and the BC Cooperative Association, and recorded by Thomas Hicks of the Necessary Voices Society on June 27, 2006. Part of the recording was rebroadcast by the CBC radio program Ideas for October 13, 2006. Find that in their archives, or look in the Tuesday Brown Bagger online archive at www.ecoshock.net/brownbagger. You can search by speaker, in this case, Lewis, Avi, or by the title, Global Economic Justice. That's ecoshock.net/brownbagger. Join us every Tuesday at noon on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio for stimulating speeches and panel discussions recorded right here in your Vancouver.